Okay, طيب we will start, so I just wanted to test that the connection is okay one more time. Hello? Yeah, it's working. Welcome everybody. Thank you for coming today. I'm Patricia Karam, a senior program officer at USIP, and I'll be moderating the panel today. I want to ask you to please turn off the cell phones because it can interfere with the phone connection we have today with Usama Safa. So let's begin. The recent war has destroyed much of the work done on rebuilding the country since the end of hostilities in 1990. How, indeed, do we put Lebanon back together again? Sweden is hosting, as we speak, a donors conference with some 60 countries in attendance that is aimed at raising $500 million to help rebuild Lebanon's shattered infrastructure. The priority, of course, will be short-term relief to restore basic services such as safe water and electricity to areas where these have been disrupted, and to deal with around 1 million people displaced by the conflict who are now returning to the south, many to destroyed homes, destroyed homes amounting to about 15,000, according to UNDP. Also, there is the bombing of a power station south of Beirut, which has caused an environmental disaster with the spillage of up to 15,000 tons of heavy fuel on Lebanon's coast. The long-term reconstruction of Lebanon, however, is expected to cost billions of dollars. The latest figures from the Lebanese government claim that reconstruction costs and losses of earnings could amount to $10 billion, and perhaps that Mr. Garvelink and Mr. Sahir will be able to tell us more about this. So today, as the Signora government prepares to embark once again on a massive reconstruction task, the question of financing the reconstruction becomes critical. Aside from the issue of grant financing and the implications of certain outside sourcing options, which David Schenker will address today, the subject of structural options, structural economic reform, will need to be reopened. If you recall, before the crisis broke out, the Signora government had been trying to arrange a donor conference in Beirut to secure billions of dollars of concessionary finance to help Lebanon service its debt. Lebanon's public debt, mostly accrued after the 75-90 civil war, is worth almost twice the country's GDP, one of the heftiest in the world. International aid, however, was to be linked to reforms, among which public department reform and such things as new flat income tax, tax charged on bank interest, and privatization of telecoms and electricity. These reforms had been held up mostly by political wrangling among rival factions and opposition, including from Hezbollah, but at the time, the blockage was not considered to have potentially catastrophic effects because of the strength of capital inflows from the Gulf and the vibrancy of the tourism industry. Obviously, this is no longer the case. The direction of Lebanese economic policy will therefore be vital as the government faces up to the challenge of reconstruction. Nevertheless, reconstruction and the economic policy that will fuel it cannot be dissociated from the broader political dynamic, and indeed the reality, as a number of political analysts have pointed out, of two competing projects battling for dominance in the post-war environment: the Signora state project versus the Hezbollah project that is backed by Iran and any remaining pro-Syrian forces in the country. Hezbollah's weapons are, of course, at the core of the issue, an issue whose resolution will be key in determining if the ceasefire can turn into a lasting political arrangement. In some ways, as soon as Hezbollah had endorsed Signora's ceasefire plan and approved the cabinet's decision to mobilize some 15,000 Lebanese army troops for deployment in the south, it had implicitly acknowledged that its military wing must be demobilized. In reality, however, Hezbollah is unlikely to stop insisting that its forces have an important role to play in defending the country. At the same time, any attempt by the Lebanese army or by any UN multinational force to disarm Hezbollah, especially in light of the movement's new political standing in the area, is risky, and one, as Amal Saad Ghareyeb has pointed out, that can result in strife either between Lebanon and Israel or within Lebanon itself. Looking at financing of reconstruction in the Beirut Dahya neighborhood, the southern suburbs of Beirut, and in southern villages and towns, and perhaps that Hassan Nemni can give us some insight into this based on his recent trip, Gulf states have made it clear that they wish their aid to be channeled through state institutions. And already some, like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, have contributed aid to buttress the Lebanese Central Bank and to help sustain financial and monetary stability in the short term and to be used for emergency relief work. So both Prime Minister Siniora and Hezbollah stand to gain considerably from the management of reconstruction, which is likely to lead to intense competition for control over resources. Where does it leave us now? This is what today's panelists will attempt to unravel for us. What are the reconstruction priorities, the challenges, the feasibilities? What are the implications of sourcing models for this reconstruction? Who should lead this effort? Mr. Garvelink, Senior Deputy Assistant Administrator of USAID's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance, will address the extent of the recent war's damage, providing a humanitarian update. Mr. Schenker, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute, will address the international dimension, specifically the regional actors' role in financing the reconstruction, the sourcing question. Hassan Nemni, who is columnist at Al Hayat and director of documentation at the Iraq Memory Foundation, will talk about feasibility and challenges of reconstruction with observations based on a recent assessment trip. Osama Safa, who is on the phone with us, general director of the Lebanese Center for Policy Studies, will provide us with some ground truth and will discuss the effect of the war on the repositioning of Lebanese forces internally, linking this to the challenges facing the Lebanese government on the social reconstruction front. Mr. Saghir from the World Bank will act as a discussant, tying strings together, but putting it all within the framework of previous reconstruction efforts. You have their bios in front of you, so I will not go into them in details. I will hand it over to Mr. Garvelink, and I will ask panelists to come up to the podium and speak. Okay, so I will ask the panelists to stay in their seats while they speak. But I would like to remind them not to take more than about 12 minutes, and I will be relatively strictly enforcing those rules. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. What I would like to do this morning is talk briefly about the humanitarian situation that we see today, and then talk a bit about what the United States government has done and will do and how that relates initially to reconstruction ideas and plans that are being formulated right now. As many of you know, the war produced about 1 million displaced people who moved northward in Lebanon or moved across the border into Syria as refugees. Most of those displaced people lived with families. A large portion lived in public buildings and schools, and then the rest were refugees. With the August 14 ceasefire, these people began to return home very quickly, and they returned in one of three ways, and we tend to generalize this. In some instances, a family member returned to their home to look at the condition of the property and to reclaim their property. Another option. Is this better now?
Is this better, guys?
Better a bit?
Yes. Can you talk down the telephone?
Yes, the telephone is under coming.
Okay, shall I give it a whirl again?
From the top.
Yeah, no, I'll continue on. I'm just wondering when. Ready? I'll continue. I was saying there's three options for people returning home. One was the individual going home to check on property. The other is the family moves home to take up residence in whatever's left of their home. And the third is the families will move to the same village or nearby village where they can begin to work on rebuilding and reconstituting their home. So these are the, when we talk about folks going home, it's as families or partial families, and sometimes not completely all the way home, but close. About 250,000 people remain as displaced people and are living with families throughout Lebanon. As a result of the ceasefire, our NGOs and UN partners have been able to do much more in-depth assessments than they were able to do during the war. What we found, and it's not surprising, is that the displaced population, whether the population that has returned to their homes or remain displaced, will require humanitarian assistance for some time. And that's water, sanitation, health care, food, that sort of thing. Shelter rehabilitation and road and bridge reconstruction will be very important, as we all know, this infrastructure was heavily damaged during the fighting. 60% of the people in southern Lebanon and a higher number in the Bekaa Valley do not have regular access to clean water. This is due to infrastructure damage and to shortages of electricity. So this is one of the highest priorities that the humanitarian community is focused on, is to provide clean water initially through trucks and to repair water systems as quickly as possible for communities. There is some revival of commercial activities, but unemployment is very high throughout the regions of southern Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. Artisans, shopkeepers have a difficult time restarting their businesses. They don't have the resources to do that. Fishermen mostly cannot fish because of the oil spill that we're all familiar with. Harvests are severely damaged as a result of the fighting. And one of the major problems that will confront everyone for some period of time is the difficulty of unexploded ordnance throughout southern Lebanon. The level of unexploded ordnance, people tell us, is higher than it was in Iraq in 2005. So it's a major problem and a very expensive and slow one to deal with. So that's a general snapshot. The displaced population is going to need more assistance. A lot of reconstruction is going to have to happen. Business and commercial activity is very limited, and there'll have to be a good deal of assistance to help these small businessmen restart their activities. And it'll all have to be done in the midst of unexploded ordnance, which will make everything very dangerous and very complicated. A couple of words about what the United States has done and is planning to do. When the fighting started on July 12, the first priority of the United States government was to assist its citizens leaving Lebanon. As that was going on, the humanitarian side of the U.S. government was very active as well. We activated our operations center in Washington. We mobilized the disaster assistance response team, we call a DART team, and we began shipping commodities from our stockpiles in Dubai and Pisa, Italy. So as American citizens were being taken out, humanitarian supplies were being flown into the port and into the embassy compound. So within about a week of when the fighting started, we had a disaster assistance response team on the ground in the embassy compound, had provided blankets, tarps, and other commodities, health kits. And when we talk about a health kit is about a ton in weight and will take a place that will take about half this room in size, and it's medical supplies for 10,000 people for 3 months. So when we talk about a health kit, we're basically talking about a clinic in a box. So we provided 18 or 20 of those to provide basic medical care to the displaced populations. we followed our normal sequence in providing assistance under these circumstances. First, commodities that we know will be required, and as I mentioned, they were shipped from our stockpiles. Then funding to the United Nations, which will get its the World Food Program, OCHA, the various UNDP up and running through the emergency situation. And then over a period of a week or 10 days, this gives NGOs time to put together their proposals and submit them. So the sequence we usually follow is commodities from our stockpiles, funding to UN agencies, and then funding to NGOs who are much more targeted and focused in what they do. And that's the sequence we followed. Our current activities. We will continue emergency assistance to the displaced populations, whether they have returned to their homes and are beginning to think about rebuilding their houses, or whether they are still displaced in other parts of Lebanon. We're beginning, though, to shift our focus to rehabilitation-type activities, and whenever possible, they will be labor-intensive activities that require or that will use local labor and local companies. And we're focused on six basic areas. We're going to emphasize school rehabilitation. And most of the schools are empty, but they need doors, windows. They have to be cleaned up, this sort of thing, which, again, is hopefully labor-intensive and will provide short-term employment. Community water systems have to be rehabilitated. That's one of the major needs in the South and in the Baca Valley. So these are not rebuilding brand new systems. These are rehabilitating systems that did work prior to the war. Healthcare will be a focus, assisting staffs in hospitals and having mobile clinics to reach folks who are unable to go to the hospitals, either due to infrastructure damage or illness. Livelihood restoration is going to be a focus. Sewing machines for seamstresses, fishing equipment and parts for boats for fishermen, agricultural implements and seeds for folks who are engaged in agriculture, ovens for bakers to bake bread. So we're focused on small-scale businessmen and helping them get their business up and running and get local economies moving again. Minor repairs to roads and bridges. These will be through our NGO partners, and that's pothole rehabilitation, fixing, that sort of thing, not major repairs. That will come later, and others will do this. And then the other thing that we'll focus on is shelter rehabilitation. Through our NGOs, what we're going to do is if a shelter, a house, is mildly damaged, windows, doors, that sort of thing, people can go about and do that and submit a voucher to our NGOs, and the NGO will look at the repairs done and pay the voucher. If the damage is a little bit more extensive than that, the NGO will hire a contractor and do a contract for the repair of the house. If it's going to be long-term damage, our folks will assist with providing a warm room, a living area, a toilet, and a kitchen for cooking that will get them through the time to rebuild their houses. These are the activities that are underway right now and will lead into reconstruction activities that are currently being planned. And the five priority areas at this point in time, and I don't know exactly what's happening in Stockholm right now, so this all could change a little bit today. But the priority areas are road and bridge rebuilding, housing rebuilding, rehabilitation of schools, assisting in the oil spill cleanup, and assisting with the removal of unexploded ordnance. So these are the areas that we'll probably focus on in the longer term, but I'm less familiar with the reconstruction side of things than the humanitarian assistance side. As you know, the United States government has pledged $230 million for these activities, and so far we've spent about $55 million of that on humanitarian and rehabilitation activities, the kinds of things I've mentioned. So that's sort of a quick run of our humanitarian and rehabilitation activities and our lead up into reconstruction activities that are being planned right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Govling. David Schenkler is next.
Uh,
been asked to speak today about the sourcing aspect of the reconstruction of Lebanon. Much of this is being hashed out as we speak today in Stockholm, where 60 countries are meeting to discuss this very issue. So far, so given that this is, for the moment, a moving target, what I want to do with my allotted time is to provide some context as to how to understand the forces at work in funding of Lebanon's reconstruction, and then review some specifics of what we know so far about commitments. The stated goal of the Stockholm Conference is to raise $500 million. That's over and above the commitments already on the table from the Gulf, the United States, the Europe, and international organizations. Mr. Garvelink gave quite a thorough overview of what the extent of the damage is and the challenge that lies before Lebanon, the international community. Given the extent of the damage, it's quite obvious that $500 million will only constitute part of what will be required to reconstruct Lebanon. The typical figures we've seen so far are about $3.6 billion. That's a lot of money, but it's important to remember that this number only amounts to about 10% of Lebanon's current debt of nearly $40 billion, which was pointed out earlier is some 200% of GDP. So Lebanon is starting this process from a serious deficit. And the Stockholm Conference is just the start of the reconstruction process. It's also an opportunity, as an aside, to strengthen the Sinora government. They're currently undergoing challenges from General Aoun and Hezbollah. So too, yesterday, the announcement by the Sinora government that it would provide $33,000 per family to rebuild housing should strengthen the Sinora government. Indeed, well before the Hezbollah-Israel war started, the administration, the U.S. administration, had been coordinating with the Europeans to convene a post-Syria withdrawal reconstruction conference for Lebanon. This conference, as it was conceived, went well beyond the $4 billion, the $3.6 billion, focusing on how Lebanon would contend with its nearly $40 billion of debt and deal with tough issues like economic reform. So the Stockholm Conference is important to demonstrate international support for the physical reconstruction of Lebanon. And the next conference, which is probably more important for the general future of Lebanon, will focus on Lebanon's economic reconstruction, which will hopefully be reconvened in October or November. Regarding the physical reconstruction of Lebanon, I see two major themes underpinning how the reconstruction financing will proceed. The first is the regional dimension. And by this, I'm talking about the context of the Sunni-Shia conflict. And this was ongoing well before the Hezbollah-Israel war. Although Hezbollah's perceived success against Israel resonated in the Arab street, moderate Sunni Muslim leaders are not pleased and are concerned about the Iranian inroads into the Arab Middle East. For example, earlier this week, a leading Saudi sheikh and a member of the Saudi religious establishment issued a fatwa saying that all Shiites were infidels, including Hezbollah, which is loyal to Iran. The West, too, is concerned. In fact, the French have urged international community, particularly the Gulf states, to step up and not allow Hezbollah and, by extension, Iran to monopolize political benefit from the reconstruction. The second theme regards the domestic politics of Lebanon. I know Hassan will talk about this more. I don't want to get too much into his lane, but this is an important issue and a key element of my discussion. And this concerns the issues of competency and competition between the Sinora government and Hezbollah. The Sinora government, saddled by the Lebanese bureaucracy, has clearly not responded as quickly as Hezbollah on the ground. Hezbollah was handing out $12,000 to $15,000 per family and surveying and cleaning up the destruction immediately after the ceasefire, while the government of Sinora took about 10 days to get into the game. If the Sinora government is to be seen as responsive, it's going to have to start moving quickly, and it's going to have to collect a lot of money. So what's happening so far on the ground? Even before the war had ended, Saudi Arabia had made a significant commitment. The kingdom donated $500 million and pledged $1 billion to support Lebanon's currency. And as an aside, the Saudis typically do not request these loans to be repaid. So the Saudi $1 billion pledge is significant, as it will decrease pressure on the Lebanese pound, shoring up local currency deposits and preventing dollarization. According to the Lebanese Treasury, the pressure on the Lebanese pound has already cost the Central Bank of Lebanon $2 billion, or 2.5% of total bank deposits. Kuwait, too, committed some $800 million. The Yemeni president, Ali Abdel Saleh, said he would volunteer $5 million in public donations that he received for his campaign for this presidential election. The elections will happen on the 20th of September. It's very generous given that in the last elections he only received 98% or so of the vote. During a speech on LBC on August 23rd, Prime Minister Sinoor rolled out the Lebanese government's reconstructive strategy, asking donors to quote-unquote take responsibility for rebuilding specific villages hit by Israel. Several Arab states have followed already Sinoor's recommendation to quote-unquote adopt an Arab village. Qatar, for example, has pledged to rebuild Bint Jebel in Khiyam, a Shiite town near the border with Israel, and Abu Dhabi has pledged to aid in the reconstruction and rehabilitation of schools in southern Lebanon and hospitals in Bint Jebel, Marjaoun, and Al-Arqub. They've also said they would provide compensation for fishermen. As for the Arab League, it's largely been missing in action. Arab foreign ministers convened in Cairo on the 20th of August to discuss the rebuilding of Lebanon, but the meeting adjourned without much accomplished, and it was agreed that discussion would continue sometime in September. In terms of other significant international actors, as we've been told, the U.S. government has pledged $230 million for the reconstruction of Lebanon and has made commitments to demining projects as well as funding for the Lebanese armed forces, which I'd be pleased to discuss in the Q&A if it comes up. I think this is a significant aspect of the reconstruction. Canada has pledged $22 million. The European Union said last week that it would pledge $54 million and it did, at the conference on top of $64 million it has already earmarked for emergency relief. The French themselves have deployed some 240 troops from an engineering battalion to build 15 temporary bridges in Lebanon. They've also pledged funds to help clean up the environment. The Netherlands has committed $8 or $9 million to help rebuild Lebanon. At last, and certainly not least, is Iran. Figures are sketchy as to the level of Iranian financial involvement support for the reconstruction. We know that Iranian funding for Hezbollah is believed to be between $100 and $200 million per year. Assistant Secretary of Treasury Stuart Levy said yesterday it was $100. We also know that Iran was involved in the relief effort from very early on. On August 11th, the Iranian news agency reported that Tehran had provided some $26.5 million in relief assistance to Hezbollah since the beginning of the war. Now, Iran has denied that it is involved in the reconstruction of South Lebanon, but I'm inclined to believe Nick Blanford, who's a reporter for Time, the Christian Science Monitor, and others, very has a very good knowledge of Hezbollah. His recent reporting suggests that Iran is taking a very active role. Of course, Hezbollah is not without its own sources of funding beside Iran. It owns businesses in Lebanon, after all, and receives plenty of Lebanese Shiite expatriate remittances from abroad. And the numbers are huge. At the time of the ceasefire on August 14th, Hezbollah started to move to pay this $12,000 per family for rent and furniture to some 15,000 people. And the simple math alone suggests this will cost $180 million. The government of Lebanon has said that Hezbollah has already received an initial tranche of $150 million from Iran. On top of this would be the rebuilding costs of buildings and other infrastructure in the south and Dahiyat. It's unclear what role the central government of Lebanon will play in the rebuilding of the south of these specific facilities. Well, press accounts indicate that Hezbollah has nearly completed its own damage survey of the Beirut suburbs, and Hezbollah's new organization, Jihad al-Bina, the Jihad for Reconstruction, has taken the lead. They divided the southern suburb into 86 zones and have engineers on site. And in addition to serving Shiite areas, Hezbollah is trying to improve its image by working in predominantly Sunni areas, like the northern area of Akkar. And according to a report earlier this week in L'Orient Le Jour, Hezbollah recently completed reconstruction work in Akkar, repairing 200 houses in 13 villages in the region. So to sum up, I'm optimistic that the government of Lebanon will receive enough international funding to subsidize reconstruction of Lebanon. The West and the moderate Gulf states will step up to support the reconstruction. It'll then be up to the government of Lebanon to rebuild the roads and bridges quickly and efficiently and to clean up the environment in the affected areas to demonstrate that the central government of Lebanon is an effective and credible institution. This is how the Shia-Sunni competition and the internal political rivalries in Lebanon will be fought. For Sinoor and the March 14th forces, it will not be a matter of money, I don't believe. The question will be largely whether they can get the job done. even with the best of intentions, it's not clear they'll be able to do so and survive politically. There'll be a lot of pressure on them. Should they emerge successfully, the next challenge for the Sinoar government will be whether Lebanon can move ahead with reconstructing its economy. And the reforms that will be required will be difficult to pursue in the post-war environment, particularly in the context of the Sinoar-Hezbollah competition. So on there. Thank you.
Thank you, especially for keeping to the time. I want to check if Osama is still on the line. Osama? Is he gone? Can I ask IT if Osama is still on the line? Sorry?
Keep
it down, but I just want to make sure he's on. I will turn it over to Hassan. Hassan Nenni.
Okay, I will leave for Osama the discussion of the specifics of the realignments in political alliances and in... in Lebanon as a result of this this war. However, I would like to place the issues facing reconstruction, which are many, in a political context nonetheless. And to do that, I'd like to go back to just before the war, describing what can be portrayed, if you'd like, a macro vision of the political situation, and to see how that got affected and how that the result of that has led to a new backdrop against which these issues emerge. Prior to the war, we can speak about two political projects in Lebanon. One would be termed a project of peace, premised on the conviction that creating an economic cycle characterized by stability and prosperity, both locally, that is in Lebanon, and regionally, will push the ideological and historical differences to the background, and therefore will enable the peaceful resolution of these issues down the line as time passes. This was one project, largely largely embodied, if you'd like, in the so-called forces of the 14th of March, which had won the majority in parliament and which were the majority in the government itself. Another project that can be termed a project of defiance was premised on the conviction that the vision of the Middle East that conforms to the specifications of the opponents, namely Israel and the United States, is incompatible with the interests of Lebanon and of the region. And therefore, because they are based on an unequal relation of power and wealth between the parties, that is, the region and the U.S. and Israel. And therefore, this vision, that is, the new Middle East, will be imposed by force unless resisted and unless parties are ready to prepare for that resistance. Now, these two projects share two constants. Implicitly, they share two constants. Constant number one is that Israel engages in aggressive and disproportionately reactive action. This actually constant was further confirmed in 2006 as a result of the war that happened, but it's largely based on, if you'd like, previous instances, whether it's 1996, 1993, 1982, 1978, etc. The other constant is that the U.S. support for Israel is close to unconditional. Again, this is largely based on observations and convictions that people have. However, these two constants were integrated differently in the political calculus of the two projects. Constant one, Israel's aggressivity, was understood as being intrinsic to the nature of Israel on the part of the project of defiance, but it was understood as ranging from an overreaction caused by historical and even psychosocial context to expecting it to dissipate and eventually vanish on the part of the project of peace. That is, those who were the proponents of the project of peace thought that this aggressivity is an artifact of history rather than being intrinsic to Israel itself. As to constant number two, again, was understood by the project of peace proponents, again, as being reflective of a reality on the ground in the U.S. where electoral politics, more than anything else, dictate what kind of foreign policy ends up happening, and therefore manageable, negotiable, if you'd like. While project number one, the project of defiance understood it as being strategic and as being really built into the nature of what the U.S. is and what Israel is. The reason I'm mentioning this backdrop, it's extremely important to understand, because the political mood throughout Lebanon today can be divided. Again, about the specifics of it, we'll leave it to Osama. He'll tell you about the various political parties and what they think about it. But in general, Lebanon is torn between two feelings. One of vindication, and that is on the part of the Project of Defiance people, that, see, we told you so, the U.S. will stand with Israel, the U.S. will protect Israel. And the other feeling is one of betrayal on the part of the Project of Peace, that we did what we were supposed to do, we were a democracy, we acted the way we should act, but we were left to be destroyed. So this backdrop is extremely important in order to understand what comes next. Added to it, and with all due respect to all the efforts that I know that I've met with people who are working within USAID and with USAID, and I know that they're sincere, they're genuine, their efforts are intense. However, the general feeling about USAID in Lebanon is it's a case of too little, too late. The idea, and actually I've heard quite a bit in the South, I mean, talking to municipal leaders all across the South, that thanks but no thanks, those who paid enormously to have those cluster bombs come and destroy us cannot possibly now be giving us peanuts in order to claim that they have contributed to our reconstruction. This is, again, regardless of the validity of this argument, this is an argument that I heard repeatedly, sometimes nicely, politely, with courtesy, and sometimes with anger, and with actually with extreme anger. So I would place this political mood as factor number one in affecting reconstruction in what is to come. And actually, I would mention in that respect, just in order to be specific, because I would like the examples that I provide you to be anchored in my visit and not in opinion, not in analysis. I would mention to you the City Council of Tyre, in which upon receiving me, I was just there inquiring about what they have. Again, spontaneously spoke about whether they could pay back what the U.S. had given in terms of aid for the construction of a number of sanitary water sanitation stations, they would. But in any case, they decline any new aid that would come from the U.S. And again, the idea here that, if you like, there was a dignity issue in it, not necessarily an ideological one at all. These were not Hezbollah people. These were not supporters of any kind of military action. These were simply people reacting to what they thought is an abnormal situation, one in which a ceasefire was denied to them and in which basically the delay in the ceasefire caused nothing but death at their end. And now we have the same party that has stood in the path of the ceasefire wanting to give help. Okay, I will leave the political mood. I think I've said enough about it, and I will move to the other four issues that I consider to be important. Again, the political mood is the backdrop, but it's not the whole picture. The second issue can be is an issue of the endemic problems facing the Lebanese state and society versus the new realities or the new issues that emerged as a result of the war. In particular, what we're talking about is that Lebanon as a state has been characterized throughout its history, but it has not improved in the last decade or so by red tape, by inefficiency, and by corruption. And actually, just as an illustration again, a village in the south, Dibin, it was related to me in Dibin what kind of assistance and what kind of aid they got from the Lebanese government. They said, well, all what we have received so far is a whole caravan of Toyota SUV cars coming to us with loaves of bread. Something like at a ratio of maybe four or five relief employees in each car with maybe less in terms of weight of bread. And just to describe to you the cynicism of the people there, they said, had the bread been not perishable, chances are we would not have received it. Where is all this aid that they claim that they have received? And we know that from the paper that they have received, we have seen nothing of that, while we hear stories about this aid being sold here and there. In any case, whether this is reflective of a reality, I cannot tell, but this is the mood. And this, you will see it consistently throughout. The reality of the bureaucracy, the red tape associated with it, the inefficiency of the government and its ability to deliver, and the perception of that reality, which might be amplified, both of them are an issue that needs to be dealt with. And I have to add to it that this reality actually extends beyond the Lebanese government into a cynicism vis-a-vis everything. That international organizations, whether they are of a private nature or of a public nature, again are doubted. And again, this is felt throughout. The third issue is maybe a more important issue with regard to the future of Lebanon. It's a competition that David has mentioned already, and actually some of it is over the surface, some of it is underground. It's reconstruction as stakeholding. The idea here is whoever builds owns. And I think both the state, that is the Senora government, and Hezbollah are fully aware of this reality. This is why we have a competition going on. And actually, beyond that, there's a regional competition between Iran and the Gulf. Here, I would like actually to underline the fact that we cannot here speak about a Sunni-Shia competition or a Sunni-Shia conflict. The demarcation lines are not at all along communitarian lines. Some Sunni groups would fall under the rubric of those who are supported by Iran, while some Shia groups definitely would fall outside of that rubric. And therefore, I think it's both simplistic and counterproductive to adopt that dichotomy. It's much better for us to view it in terms of the regional competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or Iran and the Gulf Arab states, if you'd like, that complements, or for that matter, sometimes compete with the other conflict in the region between Iran on the one hand and Israel and the U.S. on the other. In any case, whether Hezbollah is going to act as a proxy in the Iranian competition, while the state will end up being viewed as a proxy in the Iranian side of the competition, while the state will be viewed as a proxy in the Arab side of the competition, will remain to be seen. Actually, there are signs that Hezbollah, which cannot be viewed as solely as an agent or a proxy for Iran, is actually softening its stand and might be willing to be engaged in what can be termed as a project of state. The fourth issue, actually just in the third issue, in the matter of reconstruction as stakeholding, I would like to mention the example of Aitarun. Aitarun is a small town, devastated, completely devastated, near the border. And the level of destruction there is actually appalling, to say the least. Actually, this, our term, is again the case in Bintijville, in Khiam, and here one cannot but notice that there's a pattern almost of a punitive action engaged. I mean, that destruction, that devastation cannot possibly be simply a matter of conflict regardless. That's another story. In the case of Aitarun, for example, there was some defensiveness. The city council of Aitarun is owned by Hezbollah. It's virtually all Hezbollah members, and the jihad of construction operates from City Hall. I mean, they're doing clearly a very thorough job, because actually throughout the south, Aitarun is marked throughout, meaning with the spray painting, every building is marked, and every building at their end is cataloged, and the damage is there. I mean, and again, this underlines again, meaning I would digress here to mention that by the time relief funds and relief efforts reach those villages coming from other sources, chances are the immediate relief needs would be done with, because Hezbollah is already on the ground doing it through its jihad of construction. But in any case, the city council of Aitarun objected considerably to the notion of any funds coming from the states on principle, not just on matters of, on ideological principle, that is, not just on matters of support for Israel. Again, underlining the risk of an ownership that would be basically to whoever is providing the money. The last issue that I would like to talk about, actually, is in terms of the issues facing reconstruction, is the now talked about elephant in the room, which is the state within the state. That is Hezbollah and its institutions. What we have here is, in its attempt to kill that state within the state, Israel seemed to have succeeded almost in killing the state, not the one that is within the state. But nonetheless, we have there are many signs in Lebanon today that indicate that there is a consciousness on the importance of a project of state, and I would argue even within the institutions of Hezbollah that consciousness is there, and I think this constitutes in my mind a serious opportunity that I hope will materialize in something that can have us be optimistic internally. Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan. We'll just turn to Osama Safa, who is on the line, but his audio needs to be turned on. Osama?
Yes.
Are you there? Yes.
otherwise, the political cycle for the court to continue and will probably take us back to the evil who would have
Thank you, Osama. I hope you stay on the line for question and answers, and I will turn it over to Jamal Sarir from the World Bank.
Well, this is indeed a very interesting discussion. It's a tough job to try put this together for an economist. So let me try to bring back the issues to a little bit much more reality check. As an economist from the World Bank, you can imagine I don't discuss the politics or the policy. At the outset, I think we need to make it very clear that any notion that I hear here about the state dying is completely a false notion. State don't die so easily. We can go through history. They agonize, they revitalize, but they don't die easily. So we have to be careful if you go as political science on the notion of the state or the nation or the citizen that this country is going right now through. The country is going through a transformation of these three notions of the nation state, the state, and the citizen of the state. And which is very healthy in my view, but let's keep it in mind that they don't die easily. So it's very quick, very easy to say die. Second, you need to keep in mind that Lebanese people and their government and their state are fantastically resilient people. And they were rebuilt. This is not an issue for negotiation, for discussion. So you have to keep this in mind as well. This is like an earthquake that happened. But we thought the earthquake during 3 weeks' time happening. Destruction, destruction, destruction. So you have to keep in mind when we look in terms of emergency response to how this earthquake has happened. When I compare to other parts of the world, usually, including in this country, earthquake happened, we wait. Something to happen to us. Help me, take me out, move me, do me something, please. And then the system wait in place. What's different here, which changed a little bit the rule of the game a bit when we look in terms of analysis, people moved from the south, stay in the public street, and the parks, did not occupy the single house, finished, they left with dignity as they came with. They were poor, they left poorer. Something very interesting is happening here. Do we understand it carefully? This is a disciplined population which is surviving for its dignity, going back to their land. Other people usually take some forever to get there. Get me somewhere to go. And we have seen across the tsunami everywhere, villages disappeared, and reconstructed other, and people moved, and that's it. A little bit of problem here and there, but that's it, history. So what you have here, a phenomena which is in terms of changing the geography of aid, is very interesting. So people returned. So when you talk about competition of donors, I call it leveraging, or competition between this party and the government. This is complementarity, and that's leveraging. There is nothing wrong with that. Who can help me is welcome. Having said that, I think it's very important that we don't forget the figures that what we are talking about. This is the government Lebanon paper presented this morning. Very interesting document. Congratulations to the government. It reads very well. For somebody in 10 days be able to put together such a clarity, I'm not sure about the figures. We're going to assess them. It's part of the job of the World Bank. But for somebody to show at the Stockholm conference and say, I have a vision of three items, immediate need, recovery, long term, and I want to do 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. Most of the donors meeting that I attend usually after crisis like that, government are under the shock and they wait for somebody to tell them what to do. So here we have, under any circumstances, Prime Minister Senyura and his team, in my view, particularly my friend the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Economy, well done. They have proposed something to the donors on which they will have now to discuss. So we're not in assessment of the assessment. So if you look at the figures now, electricity, they are asking for 114 million. I'm giving you some idea to give you a little bit where are the focus and reality is. Telecom, $134 million of damage. Transport, $484 million. Education, 36. Health, 34. Water and sanitation, 81. Shelter, around 75 million only to buy them new prefabricated under the houses. And that's exclude the figures of the housing that need to be reconstructed. But a very important figure, which is very interesting, is the industrial and agricultural production. It's 220 million right now. And every day, the economy and the sector is losing $30 million because they can't export, they cannot produce anymore. These are important figures to keep in mind here. This is the basic of the economy, the entrepreneur and the figures. So yes, it's very important that we go right away on the health, education, transport, infrastructure. But keep in mind the basic structure of this economy that need to recover. Message number one. I think the immediate, the second point that I would like Lily to mention is, if we look at the way the government of Lebanon has been in the last 15 years reacting to crisis. And we have done a little bit of analysis to understand how they react and what's their strengths, weakness, opportunities, threat, or way forward. The strengths of the previous government, this government, since the end of the war in 1989-90, is that they have developed good institutional capacity for implementing social infrastructure projects. They know how to do it. They have institutions. They're not always functioning, but they have developed enough knowledge. The difference is, unlike the previous war, the government right now has to speed up. When of their weakness in the past, they were weak on the implementation to be very quickly. Good news now, presence of very strong civil society in the last 10 years, which is one of the most readiness one in the Middle East, is very good news for Lebanon. 500 NGOs were ready to go to the south to connect the social systems, the sanitation systems, as soon as the war stopped. So this vibrant civil society is an important aspect. The weakness is that the government has at the same time to address emerging social, economic, political, and structural issue of the economy because of the debt. You cannot borrow, bottom line. They cannot borrow. Therefore, it's very important what's happening in Stockholm is to get maximum grant money to be able really to inject on the economy to start right away. They still have limited capacity to provide post-conflict social services. And that's a little bit where they had difficulties. It could explain the delay in catching up. They're good in building a road and putting a water system in place, but the post-conflict social security and the housing system never worked nicely. So they have difficulties with that. They have also, because they have limited capacity to borrow, they couldn't go on the market right away. The housing damage is by far the largest and most complex type of damage, and it represents 50%. Experience of rebuilding housing in post-conflict is the most difficult one. And I will tell you later on how we can. So the opportunity is that I think we have, the government should seize the opportunity, and the central government is essential in the reconstruction process. It's not a choice, it's not like an opportunity only. It's essential. The central government, that's where this, because when you talk about local government in Lebanon for a small country, you can do as much as minimum. But you don't talk about the centralized structure of the country yet. So we can talk about, but the central government has to really reinforce very quickly. On the issue of financing infrastructure reconstruction, it's good to know that the bulk is coming from the Arab countries, and probably the donors, including the World Bank, will put money, because this will consolidate the ties and future loans. when we are much more look at it. The threat, in my view, is that the government long and historical absence from some area could be received by some political resistance and credibility issues about are they going to deliver. And therefore, timing will be very important. I think in the thing, when we look at in terms of how we have to look at it, the immediate issue is to be able to have institutional capacities to really push and move very quickly on the ground. You need to have sector prioritization. I gave you, if we start suddenly working only on the electricity sector and keep the transport sector or the industrial sector, this will be a major issue. So the prioritization, which sector should be right away get involved, is very important. That's why the donors community is very important there. Flexible and responsive mechanism is very important. Flexibility at this stage from the donors community. Ask the question about the procedure of procurement of all those donors sitting on Stockholm, including the World Bank. It will be interesting to answer this question, actually. How long it will take to get the money in the account? We need to focus on bringing stabilities to the social system, particularly in the conflict area. Bringing the stability to the people and the social system is very important, because they return to their villages, they have nothing except their dignity, once again, and their poverty. So you need to bring something, and I think that's where the role of the government is important. The donors can support, catalyze processes, and provide immediate short-term review. The role of entrepreneur, this is a country that has a lot of small entrepreneurs. My colleague spoke to them. You definitely have to build on it and quickly interpret what needs to be done. So I think right now, from our perspective, when we look at it, quickly to conclude, the government is putting a program. The Prime Minister Senior and his team are going on the right direction. They need all support. State don't die. Government change, but state don't die. I think what we need to do here is to be coherent and try to provide all needed support to deliver to the people who want services. All the political scene behind this is very important as a background, but for the people in the street, at the end of the day, is what kind of service will be delivered to them. And if we lose this part and we do all the political economy analysis of the region, you are going to lose it both ways. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Saghir. We will now open the floor for discussion. However, I will ask you to come up to the microphone, and if you can give your name and your affiliation before you ask a question, it would be great. And I will also ask you to please limit your questions to questions and not to make comments. And if you do, I will interrupt you. So go ahead.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. The last sentence on our handout, what role is Iran seeking? That was not addressed directly, and I would like the panelists to address that question.
You want to start, David?
Well, I think I hinted at it, certainly in terms of the regional overview. Many people view the war, contrary to what Nasrallah has said, as being something that was an intentional provocation to change the focus from the Iranian nuclear file and the United Nations. And in that regard, you know, they certainly have benefited not only by world attention shifting, but also by, I would say, enhancing the regional influence of their proxy, Hezbollah, and this all accrues as a benefit to Iran, plus the focus on regional resistance, quote unquote. So, I would say that you know, it's hard to get funding, you know, funding numbers on what Iran exactly is doing, but clearly this is a chance for them to enhance their role in Lebanon. It's also a chance, depending on how the reconstruction goes, to weaken, if not topple, the Sinoara government, which would also be in Iran and Syria's interest, as well as, many say, Hezbollah's interest. So I'm not an Iran specialist, so I don't want to talk more about, you know, what Iran's strategy is or tactics, but this seems to fit into this type of framework. Maybe one of the other panelists can better address.
Hassan, do you want to address it?
In more ways than one, we can think that Iran has had the opportunity to have an accidental empire in the Middle East, largely as a result of its own opportunism, but also of American mistakes here and there, including in Lebanon. In the case of Lebanon, actually, the Iranian investment is not recent. It dates back to, not speaking now about the Iranian investment in the Shah period, but at least it dates back to the early 80s in which Iran developed what amounts to a strategic asset for itself, which is Hezbollah, but Hezbollah cannot be reduced to that. It's important to underline, well, Hezbollah is a proxy and it is a strategic asset for Iran, but also Hezbollah is an expression of an institutional growth within the Shi'i community. In any case, it is in Iran's interest to cultivate that asset and not let it go. And if that asset was at a threat of it being taken away, as actually clearly Israel and the U.S. had hoped as a result of the war, Iran had backup strategies within the Shi'i community. It has not had to go there, and it's therefore now at an advantage, meaning even the main asset is still, if not intact, at least strong enough. And as a result, what Iran is interested in is strengthening its positions across the Middle East. It's Hamas in Palestine, which, by the way, Hamas is a Sunni group, again, underlying that it's not a Sunni-Shi'i conflict. It is the Muslim Brothers across the Arab world, cultivated recently and gradually, and this explains why the Arab political system is so adamant at trying to underline the Sunni-Shi'i divide in order to maybe shield the Muslim Brothers from a connection with Iran. And it is across the board, like a chessboard with positioning your pawns here and there, and Iran is intensely active in it.
Good morning. My name is Edward Joseph. I'm with Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and I'd speaking for myself, can say that I'm very grateful for this panel and these highly informed views that you've shared with us this morning, and especially those of Mr. Hassan and the gentleman speaking from Lebanon, who gave us, I think, a very nuanced picture of political developments there. And if I could, I'd like to ask a question that, in fact, a very basic question that goes to the issue of whether this reconstruction will, in fact, lead to a permanent and stable, peaceful Lebanon, or if, unfortunately, we're just in a respite between a future conflict. And the question is this: what do you believe is Israel's strategic interest in Lebanon? And I ask that if you would like, feel free to compare it to perhaps Syria's strategic interest in the country. Are they comparable? Are they quite different? But it seems to me that that is a quite fundamental question to address, and I appreciate getting your views on that. And perhaps the gentleman who's on the line from Lebanon. Thank you.
Hassan, if you would like to take it, and Osama, please, if you can be on the qui vive, and maybe David would like to speak to that as well, because this is your expertise, at least the Syria part.
Again, without claiming to be a mind reader and knowing exactly what Israel is thinking, but I would presume that Israel would like to have secure northern borders and no threat coming from Lebanon. However, this desire might not be in agreement with the historical reality that for 18 years Israel occupied Lebanon in order to defend itself against the threat that is the result of its occupation of Lebanon, in the process creating Hezbollah and creating a dynamic that is Hezbollah gaining strength, and therefore in May-June of 2000, when Israel withdraws, we cannot claim that, okay, the book is closed and the matter is over, because the leftovers of that 18 years of occupation in the form of that militia state within a state, etc., are on the border and acquiring a dynamic of their own and actually growing. And therefore, indeed, we've been dealing over the past 6 years with that aftermath and moving in the direction of diffusing it without bloodletting. Now, what happened in July and August of 2006 is a major setback for that effort of diffusion, and we're back to a position in which basically a new dynamic of not just anger and bitterness, but a growth of that, between quotation marks, resistance, might be in place. So this is a very intricate situation right now. Clearly, Syria has interest in that instability or in the presence of that extra national force in Lebanon, because a stable Lebanon that is out of the conflict denies Syria a platform to express its rejection of the American or Israeli project for resolving the situation in the Middle East. I mean, Lebanon ends up, unfortunately, again and again, being the scene for the resolution of the problems of others. This does not mean that we do not have internal problems. We have plenty of those. But in the case of the regional conflict, clearly, we are used beyond what our problems are. I'll leave it to Osama to say more.
Osama? Is he there? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, just when we thought, you know, sort of reconstruction and the road to stability and peace, first part of the question. Just when we thought that in 1990 we are post-war recovery and going to put the world behind us, we find ourselves again after reopening the books, which in a way seems to be offering a new opportunity here, because the reconstruction from 1990 up until now went on the wrong foot. Was living with corruption, favoritism, that also indirectly affected the political situation of the country. Right now, I think the cost of this war has been high enough for both parties to come together and sit at the table and rework that political consensus. The other way is the region of worry. How much can Hezbollah and other actors keep armed fence between them and region influencers, meaning the Syrian and Iranian, and how much will Israel really stop provoking Lebanon and stop violating the 17-1 that's been moving lately and with that blockade? I think these are major factors that will contribute to longer term stability, to contribute to a sustainable ceasefire that would be the beginning, I think, to resorting back to the 1949 armistice agreement and protected by an international force, the UNSCO. I think this was the strategic interest. I agree it would happen, and given that Israel's
desire might not be in.
I'm sorry, in two.
Thank you, Osama.
I would just say really quickly, I agree with Osama and Hassan that I believe that Israel is just looking for a quiet northern border and wants nothing more. As for Syria, is a plethora of rationale and interests in Lebanon, economic, expatriate workers, political interests, controlling and dominating Lebanese internal politics and policies. Of course, leverage with Israel. Via Hezbollah. Also, by having an influence in Lebanon, they enhance their regional role, presenting themselves both as a broker and fostering themselves as a nexus of negotiations, whether it be with the Saudis or elsewhere over influence in Lebanon. You can't necessarily dismiss, although I would, the pan-Arab greater Syria idea that they believe fundamentally that this is part of Syria. Also, I think most importantly, the idea of democracies on Syrian border. We've seen that they've taken steps primarily in Iraq, but also in Lebanon to undermine this. They want to undermine the Sinwar government. They don't want the increased pressure of having pro-Western regimes on their border.
Mr. Sahir, you had a comment.
just an affirmation that related to the issue of what's the benefit of Israel or not. Reconstruction brings growth. That's an important aspect that you have to keep in mind, an economic growth. If you look what happened in the first, after the Civil War, it took a while for the economy to catch up. But at a certain time, GDP per capita moved from 800 to 2,000 in dollars per capita in almost 6 years, where we have been trying in other countries in the region to work hard and it didn't move more than 200. So in other words, reconstruction could bring growth. What's happening here is before July 12, the expectation of the government where the growth will be around 6% this year. If they would have continued on this push of economic growth and economic stability, I think this could have helped the economy in the macroeconomic framework. So we have to keep in mind that the economy was growing, and I think what will happen right now is it will be a couple of years, 3-4 years probably before it cut back, but this reconstruction effort could give it a boost and on the short term in terms of the growth, and that will be good in terms of job creation.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Nico Paulson, and I work with the LaRouche Political Action Committee. About 2 weeks ago, former Israeli Justice Minister Yossi Beilin came forward with a proposal for a second Madrid conference to create larger regional stability. And my question for the people on the panel is, do you think that any of these economic reconstruction efforts will work without occurring within that type of a larger diplomatic framework where some of the political questions are dealt with first?
Well, I'd just say two things. First of all, I don't think Yossi Beilin has a very large constituency at all in Israel. Second of all, I believe that reconstruction will work. I don't think that requires some sort of broader regional framework of peace, but for it to be sustainable, ultimately, it probably will need peace. Otherwise, you can have every 10 years Lebanon be destroyed.
Actually, I might add to that, again, this is more impressionistic. This is about the feeling in Lebanon rather than anything else. I think that for the time being, many Lebanese think that they have heard the message loud and clear from their southern neighbors, from the Israelis, that the Israelis are not interested in peace. They might be interested in calm across the border, but not interested in peace. You cannot possibly talk about peace when you come and destroy your neighbor's lot in its totality. This is how they felt. So actually, I have even heard suggestions that too bad that the Palestinians have to deal with the Israelis by necessity because they are interlocked with them. We are not. Let us build another wall. Israel seems to be very interested in walls. Let us build another wall from Nakura all across the way, across the border. Let us not have to deal with them anymore. This is not the kind of friendly relations that you can have. So I think, again, I'm here just expressing feelings. This is impressionistic. But I think it underlines the fact that there are lots of hard feelings. And for the time being, what we should hope across the Lebanese-Israeli border is a restoration of the truce, is a restoration of a situation in which there are no hostilities. But let's postpone peace up until Lebanon is rebuilt.
Osama? Wants to add something.
One more thing. Actually, the main issue in Lebanon today is not Israel. I think that there is anger towards Israel in Lebanon today, but the real anger is at the United States. There has been a paradigm shift, not just in Lebanese political thinking. I would push it beyond to Arab political thinking. Up until recently, there was a debate about who influences who between Israel and the United States with regard to the policy towards the Middle East. This debate has dramatically shifted towards the U.S. is the player, Israel is just the tool, and the anger should be directed at the U.S. Wherever I went, in the South, and this is not just Hezbollah, the signs over destruction do not say made in Israel. They say made in the USA. And that's important to note. When talk about US aid was suggested to people all over the place, a very common refrain was, let us see how many cluster bombs that money can buy, and let us see how much they have contributed to our destruction versus how much they're rebuilding. So I think this paradigm shift is important to note in terms of the US attitude towards the Middle East altogether.
My name is Pamela Olson, and I'm with the Institute for Defense Analyses, and I also recently returned from living a year and a half in the West Bank. My question is, so Prime Minister Senyora has made it fairly clear that he's not interested in a separate peace with Israel until the larger political problems are dealt with, and given that there's an Arab initiative from 2002 on the table, which agrees for the entire Arab League to recognize Israel within secure borders in return for withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza. Is there, due to this conflict, any renewed pressure either upon Israel or within Israel for giving this a hearing? And if not, what is the rationale for why not?
Well, yeah, I'm not an Israeli political analyst. I would say that the view in Israel right now is that they have one war in the south, and they just had a second war in the north, both of which I think Israel would say were not by their choosing, that this is sort of the environment that was caused by, or certainly exacerbated by, Israeli withdrawals, that a full withdrawal from Gaza resulted in Qassam's falling in Israel, that a full withdrawal from Lebanon resulted in not only ongoing fighting in Sheba, which I think there was tacit acceptance of, but in other areas that were not in dispute. I think that the idea that that there would be a willingness to move forward on sort of further withdrawals or at this point in time won't get much traction there, given, I think, this perspective. I think Olmert floated this, saying that at a certain point during the Lebanon campaign that, you know, things are going well and this will create an environment where Israel can do further withdrawals from the West Bank. I think most Israelis recognize that there is a land for peace deal and they want to leave the West Bank, and they will eventually take a decision to remove settlers, a huge number of settlers. But I don't think right now there's going to be much receptivity for that.
Well, if I may, the withdrawals don't seem to be the problem. The problem seems to be the unilateral nature of them.
Sorry, it's one question per person. There are people waiting behind you.
Okay. My name is Amal Mudallali. I'm an advisor for Mr. Saad Hariri. I was surprised that none of the panelists in Washington here mentioned the blockade, and I was very happy that Osama mentioned it from Beirut. And this is worrying for me because it means that people are getting used to it, as if it's part of normal life now to have Lebanon under sea and air blockade and almost land blockade. My question is, can we put Lebanon together, as your title suggests, without lifting this blockade and making the Lebanese and Lebanon hostage to staying inside, not being able to revive their economy? And as Mr. Sarri said, the Lebanese are able to revive their economy and able to stand on their feet if they are allowed to do that. And not, I don't think the Lebanese would want to be for a long time, even for a week or two or three, just sitting there waiting for handouts from the international community and not being able to put their economy together and starting their factories to work again. And thank you.
Mr. Berbling, you want to say something? Since you've been silent.
No, I'm enjoying listening, actually. My only comment on the blockades, and that has to be from a humanitarian perspective, is that we don't encounter any problems moving in and out with our resources as the Europeans and other parts of the international community. So from providing immediate assistance now, we're able to do it despite or move through the blockade. I know it doesn't get to your question, but that's at least from the humanitarian perspective.
Does anybody want to address the question of the blockade?
Well, I think it's untenable in the long term, certainly this half.
$30 million, because they can't export, they cannot produce anymore. These are important figures.
I don't think there's any international debate about that. I think the question is whether 1701 is being enforced and whether Hezbollah is being allowed to rearm. I don't think a sea blockade was ever, Hezbollah never received weapons, to my best understanding, via the Med. It was always, via Damascus from Tehran and then over land. And so once this can be sorted out and Hezbollah can be prevented from rearming, I think that Israel should probably stop this.
Just a quick note here to underline the fact that from a Lebanese perspective, the blockade is understood as being punitive, not as being part of any kind of embargo on Hezbollah to receive weapons. And this falls into a whole what actions have become part of the standard arsenal in international diplomacy. From a Lebanese perspective, punitive actions not only include the blockade, but actually much of the destruction that have affected Lebanese towns and villages.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to be in front of all of you today. My name is Regan Jabbar. I'm a student at the School of International Service at American University studying international peace and conflict resolution. You've expressed a mixed sentiment towards Lebanese perceptions towards Hezbollah, and I'm curious to know, without oversimplifying too much, if there is a general perception in the current political climate, and furthermore, if there are two factors, perhaps, that influence Hezbollah's future credibility.
Osama, you want to take that question?
I'm sorry, in two factors that will influence its future credibility, like whether good or bad.
Sure. I mean, look, Hezbollah remains a political party with a very strong constituency in Lebanon. Definitely, as I said, there are mixed feelings in the country. Of course, clearly, that people want to bring accountability here. They want to target very serious and tough questions to Hezbollah on what has happened. But at the same time, Hezbollah is part of the political consensus. It represents a very large community in Lebanon. It will remain a strong party there. As far as its credibility, I think Hezbollah has a lot to do first to dispel notions and accusations that it has a regional agenda. And for this, it has to continue more its transition to purely Lebanese politics. Second, to my mind, I think Hezbollah will have to probably help or at least facilitate the creation of more Shia interlocutors and political bodies in the country. We already see a new development again after this war that we have a new major Shia interlocutor, not new, basically, an old new, Shia interlocutor who is the Speaker of Parliament in the Executive Party for the past almost 2 years, has been kind of co-opted by Hezbollah. Now he's back and he's become the main Shia interlocutor in the country. And I think adding more of this, or letting more of the Shia political expression come out,
thank you, Salman. Let's go on to another one.
My name is Alia Mubayed. I'm an economist. I work for the World Bank, but I live in Dahi originally. I have a question regarding the issue of state building. I mean, and maybe it could be addressed to several of the people. I mean, don't you think that talking about a state within a state, as put by Patricia at the beginning, as opposed to opposing the Senora state to the Hezbollah state, or talking about a state to another state that was repeated that was repeated, I mean, throughout, is really another sort of a simplistic approach and also counterproductive, as mentioned by Hassan. Don't you agree that actually we are all responsible as Lebanese from all factions, but also from the Lebanese, from the international community, of weakening the state all throughout the 15 past years of reconstruction and development, quote-unquote, by either sort of keeping the statu quo or really completely overshadowing the need to build real strong state institutions responsible for provision of services in the now Hezbollah area that was, of course, left out, and it's normal to have somebody who should be providing the services, or even to really build strong institutions who could be account, who could help any politician, including the current ruling faction, either in government or in opposition, accountable to their deeds, strong audit institutions to counter corruption, etc. I mean, unfortunately, I think talking only about, don't you think that talking only about reconstruction these days, about an October or November conference on reconstruction, that we could risk falling into the same trap of really forgetting the need to build strong institutions? Shouldn't we call for a state-building conference instead of a reconstruction conference?
Actually, I agree with the essence of your question completely, especially in on the aspect of it that Lebanon as a state emerging in 1943 and moving onwards was largely a compromise between elites, urban elites of certain communities, which means that some communities were shortchanged twice, in particular the Shia community, given that the Shia elite was not part of the deal struck in the formation of Lebanon, and given that it is mostly rural, it got shortchanged twice. And as a result of that, we witness a process of alienation and of marginalization. Jebel Amel, which historically was a prosperous part of the Levant, becomes neglected, ignored, and then effectively occupied by the PLO before being occupied by the Israelis and treated as what amounted to really an occupied territory by PLO factions. In any case, and therefore, it is important to underline that in order to point to the fact that the emergence of Hezbollah as an institution-building effort is not just an Iranian creation. It is part of the indigenous reaction of the Amilites, both the clerical families and beyond, in order to reinstate something that was missing. And we witnessed a process of Lebanonization of Hezbollah. Actually, I would consider it to be very emblematic in the use of the flag. The Lebanese flag never used to appear with Hezbollah, and then gradually, the more we have an insertion of Hezbollah into the Lebanese structure altogether, state structure, we see more and more Lebanese flags, all to the point where on the 8th of March, in that famous demonstration, there were no Hezbollah flags, basically. It was all Lebanese. What we're talking about here is a process in which, indeed, we have an inclusion and incorporation. Now, the fact remains that Hezbollah was still, on the 11th of July, a decision maker outside of the realm of the state, and therefore was able to engage in an action that led to a serious setback for the state as a whole. So this is a lesson, that to have more than one decision-making center cannot be tolerated by all Lebanese. And I think this lesson is learned by the Shia community as well as by others. And what we can witness, this is why I was saying that we should be optimistic, what we can witness is a certain sense. Actually, Osama mentioned it quite forcefully. Within the Shia community, many voices that saying, do not exclude us, do not chunk us away from the collective nation state that is Lebanon. And as a result of that, we can be optimistic about a future in which, and I'm here very deliberate in stating it, the institutional building process, the institutional building experience that Hezbollah has accumulated will end up benefiting the Lebanese state, rather than simply eliminating it as if it is pariah, it is terrorist. Okay, there are aspects of it, no question about it, were terroristic. Those we need to get rid of. But the other aspects that are institution building, we need to capitalize on them in order to strengthen the state as a whole.
Sahir had a comment, and then David.
The issue is not either this one or that one. I think it's a mistake to talk about state rehabilitation versus reconstruction. reconstruction and rehabilitation is play a catalytic role in the reconstruction process of the state. If you look at the history, if you look at when Eastern Germany and Western Germany suddenly decided to come together, the first action was to look at the public utility in Eastern Germany and to see they created a joint state company to start to sell them so that ownership is diffused from both sides. Then slowly you have seen reconstruction, rehabilitation. And if you go right now to both sides of Berlin, it looks the same finally, actually. So the reconstruction played an important role because it creates the seed for the citizens of the ownership of the country. So you cannot simply have a nice conference on let's think about the state. What kind of state that you cannot afford? The other example, when we looked at the collapse of the former Soviet Union and the creation of the 15 states, I was among the first, frankly, to be lucky to go to Georgia and Tajikistan. And at that time, they had a state, but that's it. A flag. And two telephone lines international. One for the president, one for the prime minister. Nobody else had the right to call internationally. You had to put the reconstruction. You have to put the housing system. People want to see results. They don't want dreams only. So therefore, I think in this process, the sequencing could go in parallel. But I don't want to have a big conference and the donors will wait to put the tag on the reconstruction until something nice, coherent is in place. It's a process. And we have to respect the process. It takes time. And I think this country has been going through a lot of modification through its social structure that we don't want to talk about it, actually, maybe. The population has been changing a lot in terms of migration between the rural and the urban. This notion doesn't exist anymore. The education system has completely changed. This is people are now well educated from all parties, from all religion. This is a reality. So the state is being formed with different elements. How do you consolidate it in a coherent way? That's the vision, and that's where the responsibility of the government or and the citizen to go through it. But if you do a referendum about what kind of state you want to do tomorrow, I don't know what it means.
You know, the desire and the requirement that there is actually a coherent Lebanese state, not just separate loyalties to sectarian identities, is something that is definitely an urgent need for Lebanon. I don't know if a conference, certainly not an international conference, would help this. This has to be something among the Lebanese. And we saw sort of the beginnings of it after the Syrian withdrawal, certainly in March of this year, when they convened the national dialogue. Well, it's a start. I mean, I think that everybody is so concerned about slipping back into civil war that nobody is willing to emerge from the consensus politics of Lebanon, which is also a problem because if you go by consensus, you end up with Hezbollah remaining armed because they'll never concede. It's very hard to pressure them given the current political setup. Eventually, you may have to reopen Taif. I don't know. It's sort of dangerous territory. But the point about Shia, I think, questioning the monopoly on political decision-making is really an important one. And we saw this even last year when you had the lawsuit against Hezbollah by a lawyer named Mohammed Matar, who brought a lawsuit against Hezbollah for prohibiting non-Hezbollah members, non-Hezbollah Shiites from participating in the cabinet. And I think this is sort of the roots or first shot across the bow about the Hezbollah monopoly on power.
Osama?
Very strong institutions will remain a
Thank you. I will actually ask, take the three questions, and then we'll address them as a whole. So, Judy.
Judy Barslow, U.S. Institute of Peace. In a sense, the Lebanese government was betting heavily on a successful conclusion of the Oslo process, a bet which it clearly lost. And in the process of reconstructing Lebanon physically, incurred, as many speakers mentioned, billions of dollars of debt. My question is whether, with the eyes of the world now turned on Lebanon, this is an opportunity for the Lebanese government to seek debt forgiveness, and whether or not that debt is structured in such a way that that can easily be a political goal of the Lebanese government, and whether that's a part of the government's request at this point.
Thank you.
Alejandro Butel from Jefferson Waterman International. The panelists had briefly noted how there's a sort of dichotomy going on in the national politics between the March 14th group and the alliance between General Aoun and Hezbollah. And Hezbollah has been elaborated upon as well as the March 14th group. However, I just want to know, what is the role that General Aoun will be playing in this reconstruction? What are his interests, and what does he have to gain from all of this? Thank you.
Thank you.
Stefan Brathwaite, I'm an international relations analyst. This is particularly addressed to Mr. Garvelink. I'm curious to know, we've not addressed some of the, well, in part we've addressed some of the elephants in the room, which are, you know, the United States, Israel, and Iran, but there's also the issue of the upcoming domestic elections in November, and how that can sometimes have an effect on the formulation of or influence formulation of international policy. I'm curious to know whether what your opinion is of the potential effect on the possible escalation of belligerence or violent conflict resolution between the possible rejection by Iran of the, you know, whole agreement being proposed by the United Nations, and the impact that will have on relations between both Israel and Iran, and then obviously with the United States with respect to the whole reconstruction effort in Lebanon. Thank you.
On the debt forgiveness issue, maybe I wanted to ask Mr. Saghir, but I might as well ask the Lebanese government representatives here whether whether debt forgiveness is part of. Do you want to go?
Basically, most of the debt, it's a private debt. It's not a debt owned by governments. So you cannot go and ask banks and private owners of the debt to go and to forgive the debt. What you can do in this regard is to try to help with the needs which are already published by the government of Lebanon. So this is the best approach to this issue. And Lebanon doesn't have a lot of public debt owned by foreign governments. So I think this is the best way to deal with it.
Mr. Garvelink, would you like to answer the question, the massive question that was directed at you?
Well, it's always kind of a questionable situation to be the U.S. government official on a panel. This goes way beyond my expertise and my knowledge in terms of the impact of reconstruction funding and how it relates to what's going on in the region, Iran, and how it relates to domestic politics and all of that sort of thing. I'm not sure there's any direct relationship at this point in time. I think we've put up a number for providing assistance to Lebanon that's based on our best projection of need. And if there is a conference further down the line that talks more in detail about reconstruction, that will have to be evaluated against a lot of other budget requirements in the international realm. And I haven't seen a lot of, so far, I guess from where I sit on the humanitarian and rehabilitation side, the projections of numbers and assistance has been related quite closely to what our guess of what the needs may be and not to the politics of the situation.
But
Since we have just a couple of minutes left, perhaps that Osama could address the question that was posed about the role of Aoun today. Do you want to do that? Thank you, Osama. Hassan has decided that he would like to have the last word after all and rob you of the spotlight.
Just towards Osama, actually, seconding what you're saying, but I think that cynics can point to the fact that the interest of General Aoun in an alliance with Hezbollah was strictly presidential elections type of interest. Nonetheless, as a result of this alliance, we have once again a demonstration at the ground of the fact that political alliances and socio-political and socio-economic connections are not along sectarian lines. What we have actually currently two blocks in the country. Originally, each component of these blocks starts communitarian, but the blocks themselves are no longer communitarian. We have the March 14 forces that group together officially Sunni, Druze, and Christian forces together with lots of support among Shia intellectuals. And then we have the Aoun Hezbollah alliance, which has, although not officially part of it, a lot of Sunni support nonetheless. So what we have is the emergence of non-sectarian politics in Lebanon, and I think this is another example that leads us to think optimistically about the future.
I would like to thank our panelists for coming here and for their thoughtful presentations, for a great discussion, and thank you all for coming.